So this evening we've got to the second of the 10 qualities which lead to Buddhahood. And I don't know if the order of them is that important, but I think some of the most fundamental ones are near the beginning. Dana, generosity, which is last Sunday's talk, tonight on Sila. In the Pali language, morality, that's one translation. These are kind of fundamental principles, not only to Buddhism, but I guess to all religions and all religious spiritual practice. And then Buddhism has its own particular take on each one of these aspects of spiritual practice. Sila is a very fundamental one. For example, it's one of the main principles in the Eightfold Path of spiritual practice. Probably one as hears about it more formally in the context of precepts, 5 precepts and the 8 precepts and the 10 maybe. In fact, they usually colloquially, at least in Thailand, they refer to the precepts as the sila. But technically, sila is a much more comprehensive term. It's basically the kind of fundamental definition is more like our kind of behavior, our character, our habit, the way we live our life. It's not a matter of merely keeping precepts, but it's how we kind of express our life or relate to life. So maybe the something like the precepts, the basic precepts, these are kind of, you know, formal guidelines how to behave properly. But sila really means a lot more than just following some rules and regulations. There's also an attitude that goes with it. Has to be sort of be something which is integrated into our ordinary life situation, rather than just being able to follow a couple of regulations, because sometimes when life's urgencies and things come upon us, it's not the time to stop and think, which precept am I breaking or keeping or what? It needs to be more integrated into how we actually live our life. And the precepts, basically, start off with them because that's probably what we're more familiar with. They are more technically called the trainings. The word we actually recite in the Pali is Sikkhapada. And these are not commandments. I know from my Sunday school training, I can't remember what the Ten Commandments are anymore, but Sunday school was a long time ago. but anyway, the Ten Commandments, they were, I think they were given by God or something rather. The commandments, thou shalt not, right? Something like that. But the precepts in the Buddha's teachings is actually, we actually recite the formula, if we translate it to English, is that we voluntarily undertake the training to refrain from this misconduct. So there is an implication of voluntarily taking these on, and it's a training to be observed. So, for example, we try to train ourselves to follow a certain standard, maybe, and ideally, we try to refine that standard of behavior. If we realize the benefit, of course, there isn't a creator God looking over us and watching us all the time, or don't even have Santa Claus looking after us. You know? But it's founded in the principles of cause and effect. And if we do live within the guidelines of these particular ways of skillful living, then we get some positive results or skillful results out of it. And sometimes, maybe, You know, especially for something like morality, sometimes maybe the results are not so immediate to us, or not so immediately obvious to us. Maybe it's a long-term practice. You know, and in the beginning, perhaps it isn't so comfortable having to restrain some of our urges and impulses. But in the long term, we get a benefit. So when we talk about positive results, we have to think maybe in long-term perspectives rather than just immediate results. And these different precepts, these training guidelines, within the context of the principle of cause and effect, the point is that if we recognize, if we can be really honest and recognize where we are within that context, this supports meditation practice. As I mentioned, for example, already that the morality, sila, is one of the three parts of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path sometimes is divided into three parts: morality, meditation, and wisdom. And generally speaking, you know, morality is kind of emphasized as a good foundation for the practice of meditation. In one of the scriptures, it said that the keeping of morality was for the sake of freedom from remorse. If we're trying to focus our attention on the breathing or any meditation object, and if we have, you know, a lot of remorse in our minds, we have done things which are not so skillful, or we feel guilty about, or we feel some remorse about, we sit down and watch the breath, and ooh, that comes up, and this comes up, ooh, I shouldn't have said that, and I shouldn't have done that. And maybe sometimes you have these images or these thoughts come up, but if you are very confident in the practice of your morality, you say, oh, yeah, that's just a kind of a paranoid thought, or that's a kind of a disturbing thought, but it's not true. You know, some of us, maybe we're quite self-critical. In fact, this is a tendency which is quite prominent in the West, you know, self-disparagement and being very self-critical. I think it's part of just developing, giving an overemphasis to the intellectual development. You know, you develop an intellectual approach to life, and it's a critical one. This criticism also turns onto yourself sometimes. You become very self-critical. We're never good enough. We're never perfect enough. But if you are quite confident in your standard of behavior, then even you have these critical thoughts, you know, that critical mind, that disparaging mind comes up, you can say, oh, not so. That it's just part of our mind, is part of our being, maybe this critical mind. But if you feel really confident in your behavior and you've been quite honest with yourself, this critical mind comes up and you say, oh no, it's over the top. You know, we're just human beings. And sometimes we measure ourselves with these kind of absolute standards, and if we keep doing that, we'll always fail. We're never perfect enough. But if you do feel confidence in the practice of your behavior, you've tried good enough, you tried the best you can, you've tried as well as you can, maybe you haven't always succeeded, but you've been honest about it too. And within the practice of the precepts, for example, it's very important to be able to acknowledge one's mistakes. This is actually pointed out in the for our monastic rules, for example. Sometime when people came to the Buddha and they said, oh, I haven't been very honest, or I haven't been very faithful to my wife or something, he says, oh, well, it's very important to be able to acknowledge that. It's kind of fundamental to the development of morality. One can actually acknowledge that one has made a mistake. And when one acknowledges that, then one can correct it. It's when we don't acknowledge it that it becomes really kind of corrupted, and I say that's what I would call guilt. You know, you have remorse. It's very common to have remorse when you do something not so skillful. But if you try and cover it up, and you try and repress it, then you feel guilty. You know, and it's a little bit, I think, more prominent maybe in the theistic traditions, because, you know, you don't acknowledge it to yourself, but he knows. You know, Santa Claus knows, you know, that the, so you feel, you start to sweat and you get worried, and at the end of the year he'll bring out the book and he'll know. But I haven't told my mother or my father or my friends, but he knows. But if you can acknowledge, make it fully conscious, and this is also part of the whole principle of meditation practice and awareness, if you can make it fully conscious, okay, this is, you know, this is what has happened in body and speech, maybe mind. Primarily, fundamentally, the morality deals with speech and action. Behind it all, of course, is the mind. Our intentions are also a part of morality. But practically speaking, like the precepts, they just deal with speech and action. But if you can acknowledge it, make it fully conscious, then this is developing awareness. Now we're being more aware of what is actually going on in our body, in our bodily action, in our speech. And this then can perhaps lead you back to what's behind it. What's the intention behind it? What's the mind state behind it? If we don't acknowledge that we have misbehaved in body and speech, then in a way our consciousness is kind of blocked there. We gotta hold on to it. You know, something in our mind remembers it, and then we have to kind of remember it. We remember that, and we try and forget it. And so our mind is kind of clogged up with trying to suppress this action, which we aren't so proud of, we aren't so happy about. So your mind's not very clear, you know, and you're actually increasing the denial and the repression and the ignoring of what's going on in our life. We're increasing our ignorance, in other words, not our wisdom, not our mindfulness. But to be able to be fully conscious, and in some of the traditions they have a practice of confession, you know, for the monks, and every 2 weeks we are supposed to reflect upon what these 227 guidelines we have. Reflect upon them. It's a little bit complicated now because they're recited in the Pali language. Most of us don't know enough Pali to know what they are, but ideally you should reflect, you should go through them and get the English translation and know what they are. And then you recognize, oh, maybe I've stepped beyond the boundary of this guideline. And then we have the opportunity to acknowledge it, or confess, if you like. So it's really, literally, it means acknowledging that misconduct, that misbehavior to another monk. And you have to make it verbally possible. You have to speak it out. So it's not a matter of just being conscious in your mind, saying, oh yes, I dug the soil, or I broke the leaf off this branch or something. You have to actually acknowledge it to another monk. So it makes it more fully aware. You're fully aware, fully conscious of it. And when you're fully conscious of it, and part of the formula we use, is you say, oh, I've transgressed this standard, this particular standard of behavior. And the other monk says, oh, yes, please be restrained in the future. And you say, yes, sir, I'll be restrained in the future. But the real significance of it is being able to acknowledge that. And then next time, you know, if you acknowledge that that's maybe one of these tendencies, one of these particular areas where the sense of self is leaking out. Like the five precepts, for example, refraining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, intoxication. I mean, I see them in the sense that these are five particular modes of behavior which the self is leaking out. Not, if you don't take it, not taking it too literally. But if we understand the principles involved, like killing is aggression, you know, it's the aggressive activity of the ego. The stealing is a possessive one. Sexuality, or in its widest sense, it's sensuality. You know, this is another expression of the self through the senses, trying to have the senses satisfied, identify with my eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. We want to have them gratified. It gives us a sense of, you know, fulfillment then. the fourth one, lying. This is the, you know, the there's a lot of pride, for example, can be uncovered when you recognize, you know, this whole area of truthfulness. You know, that usually we're if we can't be truthful, we can't even be truthful to ourselves, how can we ever aspire to realizing the truth? And we're distorting it all the time. We aren't even able to acknowledge that, you know, the truths in little ways, how they relate to myself. You know, not only telling lies, but say exaggerating, stretching the truth a bit, distorting it. Intoxication, another way, you know, it's just sometimes life is too difficult, you know, we can't handle it. So we have to intoxicate ourselves, we have to zonk out or distract ourselves some ways. The actual precept says, intoxicating drink or drugs which cloud the mind. I remember being on a retreat one time and this man asked me a question. He says, well, what if there are drugs that make your mind more clear? They will, first of all, depending upon those drugs to make your mind clear, is getting dependent upon them, and if they aren't there, your mind's more clouded. Or, and maybe it's just a self-delusion. Yeah. And some people, they take intoxicants, they think they're being very clear. You know, I don't know how many times I was enlightened when I was drinking wine, you know, when I was traveling in Europe, you know, these profound insights. And then when you get sobered up, you realize, oh, that wasn't so wise after all, actually. It just seemed like it at the time. But then with these precepts, if we understand them in the context of meditation, then we can put some awareness to these particular areas of where the self is leaking out, where it's trying to reinforce itself then. And it's not a matter of just, you know, breaking the precepts and saying, you know, this is not nice, and I won't go to heaven, obviously, and I won't get my presents at Christmas time. But if we're really serious about spiritual practice, this is a very good opportunity to see what the nature of the self is. You know, how it expresses its particular, you know, maybe it doesn't go to the extreme where you actually kill somebody or kill an animal or an insect, but there is this self-urge for aggression, to dominate, to get control over, to maintain its dominance. You know, it's I'm doing this and I'm better, and something like killing a person, I would say, is one of the ultimate ego trips. You know, that I say I have the right to deny you of life. It's the ultimate ego trip. Whereas, even if there's somebody you disagree with, somebody you don't like, somebody who isn't living according to your standard of life, and you can still tolerate them, that requires a lot of self-surrender, doesn't it? Giving up of yourself. Whereas you just, if you're saying, oh, well, I just can't stand them, so I'm going to obliterate them. This is, I can't stand them. You know, I don't like them. It's I. And so it's raising yourself up at somebody else's expense then. But maybe having those precepts, and, you know, if we can recognize them as ways to give us a more awareness of the activity of the self, then perhaps we have these particular guidelines, and then we can actually refine them. You know, rather than say, okay, you know, I haven't killed anybody today, I haven't stolen anything, I haven't sexually abused anybody, I haven't lied, I haven't intoxicated myself. Oh, pat myself on the back. I'm a good guy today. And sometimes I've met people who, you know, they do think like that. The result of it is, in a way, they're increasing their spiritual pride, isn't it? Say, I've kept the precepts, I'm so moral, I'm so holy, I'm so moral. And then they increase in their ego. That's one of the worst kinds of conceit, you know. One of the worst kinds of conceit is a spiritual one. You know, say, I'm so holy because I keep the rules properly. And it can be quite easy to do in, say, the monastic life, you know, because we have 227 rules, you know. Not just five, but 227, so we can be really holy. Not 200 times more than everybody else, but there were some monks in Thailand, for example, and they were, you know, on one hand, they were being very good monks to keep all the rules, but in a way, they became very fundamentalist about it. They kept the rules very fundamentally, you know. And one story from Ajahn Chah's time was that, you know, we can keep sugar, for example. We can only keep sugar for 7 days. You see. But there are certain other medicines we can keep for a lifetime, like vitamin pills, you see. Say vitamins we can keep for a lifetime, or maybe the lifetime of the pills, I guess, maybe. But sugar we can only keep for 7 days, you see. So one time one of the monks noticed that the vitamin pills were sugar-coated. So he went to Ajahn Chah and he said, "Look, I can only keep these for 7 days, it's got sugar on it." And his answer was, "Are you eating it because of the sugar or because of the vitamins?" You know, use some common sense, you know. So these precepts, I say, are just guidelines. They're trainings to be followed, they're guidelines. And we need to be, of course, applying them to our life. We need to be somewhat flexible. And I think more important to know the principle behind it. They aren't an end in themselves. You know, some of the spiritual traditions, they did emphasize these, keeping the precepts, you know, meticulously, spotlessly, as an end in itself. And when you keep these rules absolutely spotlessly and unbroken, then you're guaranteed something or other, enlightenment or something, or some heavenly realm. But the Buddha pointed back at the mind, the intention behind it. So if we're keeping these rules in order to increasing our conceit, we miss the point. Of course, there still is other side effects. For example, some of these precepts, the basic five precepts, we say they're moral precepts. So they contribute to the harmony of society. They're good examples. They create a skillful social environment. If you know that your neighbors and your friends are not going to kill you or steal your things or sexually abuse you or lie to you or get intoxicated and go crazy, then you can trust them. And it creates a certain harmonious society then. Then there are others which we call the renunciant precepts. That's what it comes to, the eight precepts. You know, so refraining from cosmetics and jewelry and perfume, and refraining from dancing and singing and musical entertainments, and these are not—it's not immoral. These are renunciant precepts. It's not immoral to use cosmetics, but it's about renunciation, but giving up some of these things which are actually kind of covering up the truth. You know, people beautify their body because why? Because the body is maybe not so beautiful. Huh? If I didn't have my lipstick on this evening, if I didn't shave today, this evening, you know, I might not be so attractive. Or going to entertainments. I mean, again, there's one needs to be able to look at the intention behind it. Somebody asked me, they said, "Oh, can a monk watch television?" And I say, "Well, if it's entertainment, we shouldn't. If it's educational, it's okay." Sometimes it's educational entertainment. Or entertaining education. It gets complicated sometimes. But you have to look at your own mind then. You go back to the intention, you know, rather than looking at the letter of the rule. You know, there's a spirit and there's a letter of it. And they can support each other. Maybe it's helpful to know what the letter of the rule is sometimes. You know, in our monastic rules, for example, the Vinaya, there's a rule spelled out, and then the rule is analyzed, you know, and then there's a story. There's usually a story, first of all, a story about how the rule was created. And then there's a rule, Buddha lays down a rule, and maybe sometimes it's a bit too strict, and somebody complains and he has to adjust it again. And then there's an analysis of the rule, and then there's a list of what is not what doesn't constitute the rule, the exceptions to the rule, for example. There's always an exception if we're crazy. So the Buddha was very compassionate. Now, just like the law, actually, the law recognizes temporary insanity, doesn't it? Yeah? That's a legal out. You can be temporarily insane, and you can murder somebody, you're temporarily insane, and you get a reduced sentence. Yeah. But in these precepts, I mean, they're guidelines. I would translate them as guidelines for skillful living. An important thing is that to recognize them as guidelines, that we have to be able to, you know, first of all, point back to ourself. Look at our intentions, look at what our own particular, be honest about our own particular behavior, and what is motivating us, what is driving us in these different directions, towards aggression or possessiveness or whatever. And perhaps it can give us some clear perspective on just what are some of these forces that are driving our sense of self. And maybe on the external side of it, you know, making a more formal commitment to try to stay within the standards can be helpful. Other times it's not going to work. You know, just if there is some underlying compulsion that's driving us to become a person who steals a lot? Kleptomaniac? Yeah, maybe you're driven to be a kleptomaniac, you know, and because there's some underlying deeper tendency there. You don't have a conscious understanding that you're, you know, somebody came to see me a little while ago and they said they went into a shop and then they found themselves shoplifting. And they didn't know where that came from. They weren't short of money. They had more money, enough money to pay for these things. But, you know, maybe there was this desire for attention or something. And until we can get back to that, then just trying to prevent ourselves, you know, and inhibit ourselves is not going to get down to the real source of it. But these guidelines, you know, if we recognize them as guidelines, we can also work on them, maybe refine them. We see some of these tendencies, okay, I haven't killed anybody today, I haven't killed an animal, I haven't killed an insect, but maybe I still have these murderous thoughts. Now, maybe I have to work at that level then. And this gives me the possibility to refine it much more. Until they say that the Arahant, the fully enlightened being, is in a way they're beyond morality. Not in the sense that they can do anything, but because, if I explain it like I did before, that these breaking of these precepts is ego expressions, they have relinquished their self, their ego, so much, they're incapable of breaking the precepts. There's no self there that wants to express possessiveness and steal things, or express aggression and kill somebody. You know, there's some of the sayings of some of the enlightened Buddhist disciples. And one time there was one of them, he was out in the forest and this robber came along and threatened to kill him. And he said, "Well, go ahead. You know, no big deal. I'm perfected. I'm already fully awakened." He realized the truth. He's completed the purpose of a human life. He said, "Oh, go ahead. No big deal." You know. And the robber was so surprised by this, of course, he, "Wow, this guy's serious." And I think he became his disciple. He's so impressed by his self-surrender. So surrendered, self-surrender, he didn't even care for preserving his own life. It would have been great demerit, of course, for the robber to kill him. But then sometimes it can be helpful, maybe, if we want to refine these standards, to actually study a bit about how we can refine them, you know, for the... In the Eightfold Path, the morality, three categories of that go under the morality part: right speech, right action, right livelihood. And the right speech in the precepts is just refraining from lying. But in this right speech and Eightfold Path, there's four parts to it. So it's refraining from lying, from slander or malicious gossip, refraining from harsh speech, and refraining from frivolous or useless speech. Yeah, we speak what's important, what's useful. And then the action, the right action in the Eightfold Path, is refraining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, which also ties in with the basic five precepts. And then there's a special one, right livelihood is mentioned. It's one of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And people may wonder why right livelihood is so important, but I mean, if you have to spend quite a bit of your time making a livelihood, and it's not supporting your spiritual practice, not very skillful, is it? And what's specifically mentioned about right livelihood is refraining from trade in weapons, trade in living beings, which I guess means slavery, trading in flesh, so I guess being a butcher is not so skillful, not so right livelihood, refraining from trade in intoxication, intoxicants, and refraining from trade in poisons. I know when I was in Thailand one time, I went to stay in this monastery, and this young monk a newly ordained monk was there. He was looking after me. And he had ordained temporarily. In Thailand, some of the monasteries, they give temporary ordination because his grandmother had died. So there was six grandchildren or something or other. So they would ordain, and for maybe a week or so, then they would transfer the good action, the good karma, the merit they created, they'd cultivated, to their deceased grandmother. So he had given up his job and taken a week off holiday, and then went to become a monk. And then while he was in the monastery, he didn't have much to do. So it was actually a meditation monastery, but... So he picked up a book. He thought, well, I should use my time here. So he picked up a book and he opened the page, the first page, and it talked about right livelihood. And the first thing he read was that selling alcohol is wrong livelihood. And you know what his job was? Selling alcohol. He was a beer salesman. So when he read that, he got a bit of a shock. You know, here I am selling beer, which is wrong livelihood. So he decided to stay as a monk. It was too dangerous to go back selling beer. So 6 months later, he's still a monk in the monastery. But maybe some of us don't know. We don't know what is right livelihood. We don't see the wider context. And we just think, well, it's just a matter of making a living. See, and I get some money and I support my family. But we don't realize what is the wider context, what we're actually getting involved in not only spiritual context, but maybe for the whole social context. And in one of the collections of the Buddhist scriptures, the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha, there's in the first group of these discourses, there's a very long explanation of all kinds of things, which is actually put in the context of the Buddha does not engage in these kind of things. And there's all kinds of, you know, all kinds of things which are maybe these days wouldn't come under the category as immoral or, you know, wrong livelihood or something or other, but there's all kinds of things. And another scripture says, just in general, that any kind of livelihood which is based upon deceit or cheating or dishonesty is wrong livelihood. When I was in, Ajahn Chah was visiting Vancouver one time, and after the public talk, he asked for questions, and this student asked a question. A law student said, can I be a lawyer and have right livelihood? And I thought, well, isn't that kind of obvious, you know? Don't law students, don't lawyers keep the law, you know? But he said, this man said, well, actually, you know, it's a lot of gray areas. It's not black and white, a lot of gray areas. So Ajahn Chah's answer to him was just very simply, he just said, if I translate from the Thai, he just said, you have to be very honest with yourself. Because maybe there's no written guidelines, maybe there's no kind of rule about it, but you still have to live with your own conscience. You have to live with your own remorse or lack of it. See? So even though that the generally the laws or the standards of society can give us some kind of general standards, but then there's lots of way, a lot of gray areas around these too. You know, for example, in our Western society, it's illegal to kill somebody, right? Kill a person, but killing an animal is all right. But in Buddhist countries, killing an animal is not skillful either. You know, so sometimes people resort to various means to do this, as they have to make a livelihood. For example, I heard about the Thai fishermen. See, they don't actually kill the fish; they just take them out of the water. See. And they die themselves. And, you know, even killing an insect in Thailand, for example, is not very, looked upon as not being very skillful, see. I heard that when they were, years ago, they were trying to eliminate malaria in some of the countryside, and so they sent out these workers to spray. It was DDT they used first, to spray the mosquitoes. And they came into the villages and they said, oh, they're going to kill the mosquitoes. And they said, no, you can't kill the mosquitoes. We're Buddhists. You can't kill the mosquitoes. So that project came to an end. The villagers wouldn't allow it. But then there was somebody in the office who was very clever, so they changed the answer. So they said, they came back to the villages and they said, what are you doing with you? We're trying to get rid of malaria. Oh, okay, go ahead. See, they're not allowed to kill the mosquitoes, but they're allowed to get rid of the malaria, see. It's actually doing the same thing. But but if we understand that, for example, in the context of cause and effect, principle of cause and effect, and maybe we have to sometime, maybe sometimes it is, we're in a situation where taking life, for example, killing the mosquitoes, is necessary. Maybe we shouldn't say necessary either, but maybe that's what we have to do. You know, but we have to weigh the consequences, cause and effect. Is it better to allow people to die of malaria, human beings to die of malaria, or is it less, I would say it's less karmic consequences to kill a mosquito than it is to kill a human being, see? It's still wrong, it's still immoral, and maybe there are ways you can find that you don't have to kill the mosquito. You know, when I was in Singapore, quite keen on health in Singapore, and I remember I went past this apartment building, and some officials had a big sign outside this apartment building saying, in this apartment building, some people had left their buckets to collect rainwater. This is breeding mosquitoes. This building is watched now by the health police. So, for example, in the monastery, we're not allowed to kill the mosquitoes. So what we do is we're very careful. When we're collecting water, we have to be very careful it's always covered and that the water is filtered, that the mosquitoes don't get into it in the first place. So we don't have to kill them later. So, I mean, there are other means. I mean, some people just say, oh, just spray it, you know. But realizing that this is not very skillful, you can think of other ways, maybe. You know, I know some Buddhists in England, for example, who were gardeners, and they had difficulty with all the slugs in their garden, you know. But there are ways. If they had planted, what was it, nasturtiums, I think. If you plant nasturtiums in your garden, the slugs don't like it. Or you plant garlic or something or other, or... We had lots of fun in northeast Thailand trying to keep the ants out of our huts, you know. We can't kill the ants. We had all kinds of different... We built little moats around the huts. And then we had the moats dried up and the ants crawled across the dry... Then we put oil-soaked rags around them. And then But if we do understand that killing any living being is not very skillful, maybe we can find other ways that are possible to prevent the killing of insects and animals. You know, and maybe if you know, worse comes to worse, we have to weigh the consequences. You know, one time the some of the monks' huts at Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, were full of termites. And so the monks came to the Ajahn Chah and said, what do we do about it? You know, these termites are eating the huts, the monks' huts. He said, I'll take on the karma, he said. He said, to me, it's better that the monks have meditation huts to meditate and get enlightened rather than feed termites. So, I mean, life is not so simple, is it? I mean, sometimes we have to make these choices, these decisions. But if we understand the principles behind it, it's still unskillful. Ajahn Chah realized it's still unskillful. But he had to weigh the consequences. He had to make the choice. You know, so the precepts and the keeping of morality, I mean, maybe they give us guidelines to follow, guidelines for skillful living. And ideally, we should be able to see the results of that. You know, if one's life is more free of remorse, then yeah, meditation would be much more peaceful, much easier perhaps to focus your attention on a meditation object without your mind being disturbed by all these distractions and you know, these remorseful thoughts. And not only in terms of the moral precepts, but for example in some of the renunciant precepts. You know, I remember my first years in Thailand, sitting in the forest trying to watch the breathing, and all these old pop songs are going through my head for hours and hours, or actually for years. I think about 6 years, actually. So it's not immoral to listen to music, but there is consequences. And of course, morality is within the wider context of spiritual practice, like the Eightfold Path. Depends how we start, but I mean, usually people have a bit of faith or they have some understanding first. They want to do meditation practice. They try and do meditation, and all these confused thoughts come up, and you know, maybe these states of you know, if one has taken a lot of intoxicants, for example, and one's trying to sit and clear one's mind, and then these old states of intoxication come up and distraction. And but then if one when one can see then the results, hey, my unskillful living is having an effect upon my state of mind. So they actually get some understanding about it. So, okay, I have to straighten out my way of life, my behavior now. When the behavior becomes a little bit more skillful, then they have more peaceful states of mind, they have clearer seeing, and kind of supports more understanding then. Yeah. And of course, there is other supports. It's not a matter of just, you know, kind of grinning, just kind of gritting your teeth and enduring through the precepts, trying to keep them best you can. But sometimes it helps us to be able to observe what are some of the consequences, some of the cause and effect relationships. For example, the keeping the precepts is supported by restraint of the senses. You know, these sort of the senses get stirred up. You know, listening to music, you know, the senses get stirred up and the mind remembers it and then it comes back again in meditation. And if we have more awareness and we have more understanding of the effects the senses have upon us, we know how to live our life in a more practical or skillful way which will support the keeping of the precepts, for example, without having the senses stirred up. Another one which is mentioned specifically for the monastic and meditation practice in monastic tradition is moderation in eating. You know, eating a lot of food, for example, is a very sensual activity. And then one is a bit dull and a bit not so clear-minded, and then maybe, you know, one has thoughts which aren't so skillful, which maybe one can follow, and it leads to it going beyond the boundaries of the precepts. So living a moderate, I would say, not only moderation in eating, but a moderate lifestyle. You know, that moderation in general, the middle way, is very helpful and supportive of meditation practice. You know, even the exercises of meditation. Some people think, oh, I've really got to do some real knee-crunching meditation practice. You know, it's not the middle way, maybe. Yeah, maybe you're getting, you know, a sensual stimulation out of just particular exercise, for example. You know, it's just a sensual stimulation that your mind gets really peaceful because you're focusing on the pain in your knees. But if you continue with that, it's going to have some consequences. Your knees are going to wear out, like mine are. Because I did do a practice, I must admit, I did do a practice when I was in Thailand that in the hot season, it was very, very hot and I was very sleepy. And so I discovered that if I sit in a certain cross-leg posture, that when I sat, I got sleepier. But if I sat in a certain posture, as I sat and got sleepier, the pain got stronger. Kept me awake. So I balanced out the sleepiness with the pain. At least for an hour and a half or so I could do that until the pain got too strong. But it helped me get through at that time sleepiness, but it did not allow me to get to the real cause of the sleepiness. You know, the sleepiness was lack of mindfulness, lack of clarity of mind. But rather than developing clarity of mind, I was using the pain to keep me awake, which was a short-term solution only. And then after a while I realized this was not very, in the long term, not very useful. And then I had to try and give more energy, more attention to developing more clarity of mind, more mindfulness. So one doesn't just go blank. The mind goes blank. You aren't clear anymore. The mind goes blank and then it drifts off into unconsciousness. So the whole point of the precepts is not an end in itself, but it's within the context of the whole of the development of the spiritual practice, most particularly meditation. And what can happen is that when one understands, one can see the results of living a skillful life, supports meditation practice, then one gets some faith or some confidence into refining the behavior then, refining our way of life. A refined way of life, a refined lifestyle, behavior, becomes a way, like a habit or a character tendency. Gives a much firmer foundation for meditation again. And if we want to continue with it, we get down to different, more refined levels of mind then. You know, when our mind is being less distracted by old memories or, you know, old pop songs, you can get more deeper concentration, deeper calm of mind. And this gives more insight. So then the morality, meditation, wisdom kind of support each other. You know, it's not, I think some people, they usually think, okay, I've got to do morality first. Get that perfected. Then I can go on to meditation. Perfect meditation, then I get wise. But I don't think it works like that. My experience is that, you know, you have some skillful behavior, coming to a monastery, coming to meditation retreat. And we don't bring our iPods with us, do we? We turn off our mobile phones, so we aren't have all the stimulation, and then the mind gets a bit calmer, and then you get some insight, and you realize, oh, having a calmer mind, not being stirred up by all the songs, you know, then, okay, maybe I delete those songs from my... At least on Sundays. I get a bit of a run-up to meditation, so I don't listen to the songs in Sunday morning that come in the evening in my mind, in my meditation. But we need to really find out for ourselves. I mean, the Buddha can give us this suggestion and he can say, oh, it's beneficial, but really, for wisdom, what's wisdom is we see for ourselves. Yes, this is true. Cause and effect, relationships. Now, this is really true. I know this. I don't need to have the Buddha remind me. I know this for myself. And this allows us then not only a deeper level of meditation, but a deeper insights too, because this is where seeing these tendencies of the self now being expressed in these various types of behavior now. And it's not a matter of just, you know, five precepts. You know, the self is manifesting in all kinds of expressions. It's not just a matter of lying overtly, but maybe there's a little bit of distortion of reality, a little bit of exaggeration. So the precepts of morality, sila, virtue, whatever. I mean, this is a kind of a foundation of the spiritual practices, and in a way, it continues right through. You know, the fully enlightened being, they're, as I say, beyond morality, but they still keep morality. You know, once the monks recite our 227 rules every fortnight. And one time one of the monks thought, well, I'm a fully enlightened arahant. I don't have to recite these rules because I keep them all already. And so he went to the Buddha and told him this. The Buddha said, no, that's not very, very wise thinking. He said, you should go there anyway because this sets a very good example. You know, it sets an example for other people too. Okay, maybe it's not for you that you go there, but you go there and you keep the precepts and you follow these standards as an example for other people too. And so the fully awakened being, even though they're beyond morality, but they keep the standard. You know, they're more likely they're incapable of that ego expression which manifests as breaking the precepts. So they're already naturally inclined to be moral then. So morality then is sort of at the very beginning of the path, and it's really at the end too. One can actually perhaps judge a person's awakening or spiritual attainment by their standard of behavior. You know, and if somebody is, they say, oh, I'm enlightened, and they're living in a very unskillful way, you begin to wonder, hey, many of us have heard about these stories, you know, people claiming to be enlightened, but their life doesn't seem to be very enlightened, you know, and they leave a lot of hurt and pain and disturbance in their wake. So are they really awakened or not? I have my doubts. You know, according to the Buddhist standard, that a person who really is awakened, they are automatically moral. They automatically keep those standards of skillful living. Not only for themselves, you know, but as an example for other people as well. So the morality, I would say, is at the very beginning of spiritual practice and also at the end. And through the process, we're learning about ourselves and learning to refine that so it becomes actually our habit then. Maybe at first we take on these standards, we recite the formula, take on the five precepts, for example, but then they become part of our way of being. And they just become natural for us. We naturally don't kill, steal, sexually abuse, and lie, and intoxicate. Because now it's our habit, it's our character now. And so this morality is a very fundamental part of the spiritual practice. So we're moving on, getting closer to Buddhahood. 8 more talks. So I think I should pause there this evening.